It's case number 66652, Randolph Moore versus State. Randolph Fiedler for the appellate, Mr. Steve Owens for the respondent. And you have 60, this is a 60-minute argument.
Your Honors, I may please the court. My name is Randy Fiedler, and I represent appellant Randolph Moore. I would like to reserve 8 minutes for rebuttal. Angela Saldana was the most important witness to testify against Randolph Moore in this case, and the defense did not know the most important fact about her. Angela Saldana was the most important witness to testify against Randolph Moore in this case, and the defense did not know that her testimony was the result of threats against her life and a coercion campaign engineered by the state. The defense did not know that within a day of the homicides in this case, a DA investigator began working with Ms. Saldana's uncle to intimidate, threaten, and coerce Ms. Saldana. The defense did not know that the DA investigator was feeding Ms. Saldana's uncle police reports, and that this uncle was using those police reports to tell Ms. Saldana exactly what to say. The defense did not know that the punishment, as threatened by this uncle, for failing to do exactly as told, was implication in these homicides, resulting in imprisonment or execution. So when Ms. Saldana testified that Mr. Moore helped plan these murders, that Mr. Moore shot Carl Gordon, and that the motive for the crime was Dale Flanagan's inheritance, defense counsel did not know that they could cross-examine her about the coercion she faced or the threats compelling her testimony. The defense knew none of these things, but the state did, and they failed to disclose this impeachment information. This information was material. As Detective Geary noted in his testimony, Ms. Saldana broke open this case. Her testimony was a necessary prerequisite to convicting Mr. Moore. And the reason her testimony was a necessary prerequisite is because of the corroborative evidence rule, which states that testimony from accomplices must be corroborated by non-accomplice testimony. And in this case, Ms. Saldana was the only non-accomplice to testify against Mr. Moore. Rusty Havens testified that he was involved in planning the homicides and was supposed to kill the grandmother. Tom Akers testified that he drove them to the grandparents' house and participated in the plan to commit these homicides. John Lucas told officers twice that he helped dispose of the weapons. And he testified that he believed that if he did not testify, he was going to be charged with one of the crimes in this offense. But here, even assuming this court doesn't want to apply the corroborative evidence rule, these witnesses' testimony had substantial problems. Mr. Havens was a co-conspirator. He testified and faced no criminal liability in this case. Mr. Akers, another co-conspirator, testified, and he took a plea deal in which he pled guilty to manslaughter and received 5 years probation. Mr. Lucas, who was in the apartment when these crimes were being planned and told officers that he helped get rid of the rifles, received witness funds. So all of these witnesses during the trial were subject to cross-examination on the basis of their participation in this offense and the fact that they all benefited in one way or another from their testimony. So the evidence inculpating Mr. Moore, the evidence that is not Ms. Saldana's evidence, was not free of taint, which makes Ms. Saldana's testimony especially important. The defense cross-examination during the guilt phase in this case focused on her expectation that she was going to receive witness funds and focused on the fact that she had an ongoing relationship with two of the co-conspirators and had previously had a relationship with a police officer involved in the investigation. That impeachment is categorically different from the impeachment that was available had the state disclosed their Brady material. The state alleges and the district court found this claim is procedurally defaulted and that Mr. Moore failed to show good cause and prejudice. I would note that in this case, because this is a Brady claim, the good cause and prejudice prongs for procedural default parallel the suppression and materiality standards for Brady. And so here, the procedural default discussion collapses into the merits discussion, which leads to the question of whether this claim was raised within a reasonable amount of time when it became available. The earliest that Mr. Moore could have been aware of this evidence was when Mr. Flanagan filed the declarations of Wendy Mazaros and Amy Hanley Peoples in federal court in February of 2011. However, at that time, this claim was not available to Mr. Moore because his post-conviction appeal was still pending before this court. And as this court is aware, under Buffington, the district court would not have had jurisdiction to entertain any new claims from Mr. Moore. And Mr. Moore also could not have raised this claim in this court, as evidenced by the fact that he tried to by filing a motion for limited remand, and this court denied that motion. And so the earliest that this claim became available for Mr. Moore was when this court issued remitter in his previous post-conviction proceedings in 2012. Mr. Moore filed this claim with his other claims roughly 11 months later. There are two reasons that this was filed within a reasonable amount of time. First, as is the case with a petition challenging the effectiveness of statutorily mandated post-conviction counsel, Mr. Moore filed within a year, which is a reasonable amount of time. But second, Mr. Moore filed this claim in his petition challenging the effectiveness of his post-conviction counsel, which is to say in his Crump petition, and he filed them together, which must be reasonable because if not, this court would be condoning piecemeal litigation, which as made clear in the recent Ripo and Johnson decisions, the habeas rules do not favor. Also, the Saldana evidence in this case is important, not just because of the guilt phase, but because Ms. Saldana testified during the penalty phase, during each of the successive penalty phases. And for all the same reasons that Ms. Saldana could have been cross-examined during the guilt phase of this case, she could have been cross-examined during the penalty phase. And of particular importance is the fact that the state argued that the death penalty was appropriate because Mr. Moore and Mr. Flanagan were leaders of this group. And Ms. Saldana provided the only non-accomplice testimony. Similarly, Ms. Saldana's testimony was necessary to prove two of the aggravating circumstances, the two remaining aggravating circumstances in this case. Her testimony, again, was the only non-accomplice testimony supporting those aggravating circumstances. The problems posed by Ms. Saldana's testimony during the penalty phase are exacerbated by penalty phase counsel's ineffective assistance. During the penalty phase in this case, the mitigation theory seemed to be that Randy Moore grew up in a less than perfect home environment without a true father figure.
Before we go to that piece, what evidence was there that the people's Saldana interactions, that information was in the possession of the prosecution?
The evidence indicating that information was in possession of the prosecution was the fact that the investigator for the district attorney's office, Beecher Avans, was working with Mr. Peoples to coerce and intimidate Ms. Saldana. It was Mr. Peoples of the DA's office that was providing the police reports to Robert Peoples and working with Mr. Peoples as they were engaged in this intimidation and sort of campaign of threats against Ms. Saldana.
And one of the district court's finding that was kind of off book.
That was off book?
That the investigator's actions were kind of outside of his duties.
Whether they were outside of his duties or not, Mr. Avans was still an agent of the state, and so any knowledge that he possessed is attributable to the district attorney's office, and so part of what's required as disclosure under Brady.
Was there evidence that he was present at all the interactions with Saldana and Peoples, or even of any of the interactions with Saldana and Peoples?
The evidence is less clear on that point, but I would note that this is a case where the district court failed to grant an evidentiary hearing. And so a lot of these concerns, which are factual in nature, should be resolved in the context of a hearing. The evidence does indicate that Mr. Peoples was at least there for some of the conversations, that Mr. Peoples was closely working with Mr. Avance was there for some of the conversations, and that Mr. Avance was working closely with Mr. Peoples to sort of to get the testimony from Ms. Saldana that they wanted to get.
Thank you.
Talking about the penalty phase in this case, unless this court has any additional questions about the Brady claim. The defense mitigation theory in this case, and I'm quoting from the closing, Randy Moore grew up in a less than perfect home environment without a true father figure, entered into a foolish marriage causing him to drop out of high school. This grossly understates Mr. Moore's childhood. Mr. Moore was raised in a home with a revolving door of abusive father figures and an absent mother figure. He lost his virginity to a babysitter when he was 11, to an older babysitter when he was 11 years old. On different occasions, different father figures shook him, kicked him, threw him against the wall, threatened him with a gun, and his sister was molested by at least one stepfather. This is not the childhood that penalty-based counsel presented. This is not the childhood, not a childhood that's less than perfect. This is a childhood that left Mr. Moore with post-traumatic stress disorder, which he tried to medicate by turning to substance abuse. And no experts testified about the post-traumatic stress disorder or his reliance on drugs and alcohol to try to control it. The jury heard none of this evidence. These errors, and the other errors alleged in this appeal, must be considered with the slew of errors that this court or the state have already acknowledged. And I would note just a couple in particular. This court has found a number of these errors harmless because of the overwhelming evidence of guilt, such as twice prosecutorial misconduct during the guilt phase, once for argument, once for use of First Amendment protected behavior. Another error that this court chose not to resolve on the basis of the overwhelming evidence of guilt was a deficient performance of guilt phase counsel, which the state all but conceded during the previous post-conviction proceedings. These and the other errors recounted in the briefing show that this court can have no faith that the errors currently alleged are harmless. And the errors currently alleged should call into question this court's earlier determinations of harmless error, because it's clear that in fact there is not overwhelming evidence of guilt in this case.
And we're just looking at the penalty hearing as far as this proceeding is concerned. Is that correct?
That is not correct, Your Honor. The Brady claim affects both the guilt and the penalty phases. And of note, because Ms. Saldana's testimony was the only non-accomplice testimony as to Mr. Moore's guilt, when this court weighs the harmlessness of Ms. Saldana's, weighs the harmlessness or the error of the state's failure to disclose the evidence, this court must consider the fact that guilt phase counsel acted so egregiously bad that the state was willing to concede that the performance was troubling, that Mr. Posen had made some decisions that didn't seem to make any sense, including, as an example, asking Ms. Saldana about satanic worship evidence, which the state had already agreed they were not going to use, resulting in co-defendant's counsel moving for a mistrial.
So it's only the Brady claim that relates to the guilt or innocence phase. Everything else relates to the penalty phase?
Yes, and for purposes of this argument, I'm focusing on the Brady claim. We've alleged other errors in the briefing that addresses both the guilt and the penalty. But yes, the Brady claim implicates the guilt phase. It also implicates the penalty phase.
Why isn't there a procedural problem with the guilt phase?
Because we are alleging as good cause that the state suppressed this evidence, and because this evidence is material, we have shown both good cause and prejudice. Is that Your Honor's question?
Yeah. I'm just a little bit confused as to what's the extent of this proceeding, this particular post-conviction relief proceeding, as to that it involves guilt or innocence and also the penalty phase.
Well, perhaps this will clarify the matter. Although Mr. Moore's case obviously has an extensive procedural history, this case is before this court on what is, in effect, a crump petition, or a petition after his first state post-conviction proceedings resolved, and he has filed this petition to allege that his post-conviction attorneys were ineffective.
Whatever he prevailed before was only on the penalty hearing. It was never on the guilt or innocence phase. Is that correct? When he prevailed?
That is correct. I mean, this court has acknowledged errors that occurred during the guilt phase and found them to be harmless. But both times that Mr. Moore received relief from this court, it was for penalty phase only.
Who was his trial attorney? I forgot.
Murray Poza, who evidently suffered from a hearing problem, which is clear in the trial transcripts.
Did he try it by himself, or did he have co-counsel?
He had worse than co-counsel. He did not have co-counsel for Mr. Moore. But this case was tried with all of the other co-defendants. And so Mr. Posen's defense theme seemed to be to just ride along with the other counsel's motions and objections, sort of ignoring the fact that the other defendants had reasons to implicate Moore and incentives to implicate Moore. Based on the error related to Ms. Saldana and based on the ineffective assistance of the penalty phase counsel in this case, and also the long history of errors which have occurred, we request that this court reverse the district court and grant Mr. Moore habeas relief on the alternative remand this case for an evidentiary hearing so that he can show that he can establish good cause and prejudice and show the merits of his claims. Unless the court has any additional questions, I would reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Just briefly, how do you deal with Turner versus United States?
Are you referring
to when you're talking about materiality? How are you going to distinguish Turner versus United States?
I hate to admit, I'm not familiar enough with Turner v. United States to understand the court's question.
Anything further, Mr. Court? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Owens? Is it the state's position that the only thing before us today is the penalty hearing, penalty phase? Is that your position?
Well, all the claims they've alleged in their brief are properly before the court. I think they're all procedurally barred. The guilt occurred in 1984. The trial for the murder was in 84. The first trial was in 85, and this court did affirm as the guilt and has reversed repeatedly on the penalty hearing. So we're pretty far removed from any of the guilt phase proceedings, including Murray Posen's performance. To get Murray Posen's performance, you'd have to say that Janelle Thomas was ineffective in failing to raise ineffectiveness regarding David Sheik, who in turn was ineffective in failing to properly allege ineffectiveness of Murray Posen. And so we're like three steps removed. I don't see how the procedural bar is going to take us back that far to the guilt phase claims. So the court below denied even the first penalty phases, the third penalty counsel's performance, that's David Sheep, denied that claim based on procedural bar saying it was untimely raised. At that time, the law in this state was simply that you have to get back pretty quickly within a reasonable time to allege ineffective assistance of prior post-conviction counsel. It was later in RIPPO that this court adopted that one-year rule. RIPPO's now been reversed or vacated and remanded back to this court. So I assume we'll go back to that one-year rule at some point, either in RIPPO or in this case. That was a rule that the federal public defender lobbied for. I was pushing for a more narrow window, similar to Brady claims. You have to come back that a reasonable time of the claim becoming available. This court went with a bright line rule that for ineffective assistance of prior post-conviction counsel, it's 1 year grace period basically to get back. And so if that stays the rule, then they did get back within 1 year. And so I don't know that how much I want to argue that, but the court initially below found that it was untimely raised, even though it was barely within a year, the court found it was untimely raised. Alternatively, the court did reach the merits of the ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel claim and under the prejudice prong and said even if you had good cause for coming back untimely in a successive petition, I still find there's no prejudice because Janelle Thomas in fact raised most if not all of these claims and they're just coming back now in a little bit more detail, but the substance of them was previously addressed. So I think that's how we deal with the ineffectiveness claim. I don't see anything hugely different here than what Janelle Thomas already raised. And if they want to attack Janelle Thomas's performance, she filed a huge brief. She had the case for many years and raised all kinds of issues. She has a reputation for being one of the most thorough post-conviction attorneys we have. In her affidavit acquired by the federal public defender, she said she focused most of her issues on guilt, and they're faulting her for that. They're saying she should have spent more time on some of the penalty phase issues, but she said she did that because her client, Randolph Moore, was interested in challenging guilt. I think we have to respect the wishes of Randolph Moore. He's ridden this case out for 35 years. He's seen the writing on the wall that no matter how many times we go back and do the penalty hearing, we keep getting the death verdict. Three times now. the sentence imposed has been the death penalty. And so Randolph Moore wants to challenge guilt. And so that's where Janelle put her energies. I think strategically, that's kind of wise. I know the death penalty is like this political hot potato, and the defense bar is like, well, we got to attack the death penalty. The reality is that many of those on death row would rather have the death penalty imposed if they're going to be found guilty rather than spend the rest of their natural life in prison. That's a reasonable way of looking at it. So Janelle's not ineffective in the performance that she did, attacking guilt unsuccessfully, but they just added a few more points, a few more details here. They've got an expert now. And to overcome the penalty hearing with new mitigation evidence now, that you better come up with something pretty dramatic, as we've shown that none of this has made a difference in the past. Each time the death penalty has been vacated, it's been based on some legal finding that if this error hadn't occurred, then there's a reasonable probability he would have received a sentence less than death. Well, that hasn't proven to be true. And so if we're to reverse the penalty hearing again, there better be something pretty substantial. And what the expert here in this case that they've now got says is that Randolph Moore suffers from ADHD, depression, and post-traumatic stress syndrome. Pretty minor psychological profile in the scheme of things relative to capital defendants. Nothing too earth-shattering there that really would have made a significant difference with any of the juries in this case, I don't believe. In fact, any time to go get an expert, it's a two-edged sword. The report in this case indicates Randolph Moore has an IQ of 128, putting him in the 97th percentile. There's a lot that a prosecutor can do with that. It's not that an expert's going to be 100% helpful to the defense. There's always a side to it that the prosecution can turn to its own advantage. And so his high IQ is something that would have cut against him. There's also the possibility of reopening the door to some of the satanic worship evidence that they wanted to keep out. Randolph Moore was a self-proclaimed wizard, dabbling in the mystical arts, and white magic is what he called it. Dale Flanagan, his co-defendant, practiced in the black arts, dark magic, and together they were quite the team. And so in a psychological profile, putting forward mitigation, you may open the door to some of that stuff. So that's what the U.S. Supreme Court said in Cullen v. Pinholster and Harrington v. Richter, that there's all kinds of experts that can be of use, but that it's a two-edged sword and it can cut against the defense. So I really don't see anything different there in terms of a penalty hearing counsel's performance. It was David Sheik. And you only get to David Sheik's performance if you get through Janelle Thomas. You have to call both of them ineffective at this stage to be able to reach that in reverse on the penalty hearing.
Can you address for me the Brady argument and why, in your estimation, that does not carry?
I'm a little curious because both the co-defendant Flanagan and Randolph Moore were pending appeal at the same time. This court, more than a year ago, affirmed these exact same Brady claims on Dale Flanagan. No evidentiary hearing was required, and it was denied. I don't know how this court reaches a contrary result. That's why I filed supplemental authorities and attached that unpublished order of affirmance, because I think it is law of the case, since these two went to trial together and faced the death penalty three times together. So if there was no evidentiary hearing required there and it was procedurally barred in Flanagan, I don't know how this court possibly says something different to Randolph Moore without reopening Flanagan. If this court were to grant relief based on the Brady claims and remand for an evidentiary hearing or just outright reverse, Flanagan's going to be getting the same treatment. He'll be in here tomorrow raising these claims. This court in Flanagan denied it as procedurally barred. It was untimely raised by Flanagan. And if so, then it's even more untimely when raised about a year later by co-defendant Randolph Moore here.
Except he's making the argument that he can come through because this is his second post-conviction.
I think it was Dale Flanagan's second post-conviction, too.
Was it, too? Okay.
Yeah. They've been proceeding threw the system pretty much together. They got a little bit off here during this last appeal. Randolph Moore started a little bit later, and then Flanagan certainly was already decided a year ago, but briefing had been completed in this case at the time that this court ruled on Dale Flanagan's issue.
Well, address for me, if you will, the materiality issue on the Brady issue.
Certainly. With any Brady claim, you have to show it was withheld and that it's exculpatory and that it's material. Before you reach the materiality, I don't think they meet the first two prongs or that it was timely raised. But in terms of materiality, I guess our best argument is that 95-98% of this was raised previously and found to have not made a difference in the outcome of the case.
That's kind of what I'm struggling with. What is new and why would it matter?
Right. Most of it is not new. There's a few little bits and pieces, and you have to, they don't do that work for you. They throw it all out there as if it's all discovered here today. And I think I showed in my brief that this claim has been raised in different forms since 1985. Even pre-trial, they were going after Angela Saldana, trying to show that there was this relationship and that she was coerced or coached or that she was just an agent of the state. And so it's been raised repeatedly, and Angela had testified in this case repeatedly at penalty hearings. And so it's been raised time and time again. They've got a few new snippets here. I did my best to kind of cull through it and try to figure out what was analyzed previously and found to be not material for Brady purposes in this case, and what new do they have? And it's a very, very narrow window there of actually new things that they've got that they did not know previously. There's nothing cumulatively new there that is going to make a difference in this case that wasn't already considered as law of the case. On the timeliness of it, they knew in February 2011 about these affidavits, and they got them from their co-defendant Dale Flanagan, and they didn't raise them the way they should, which is in a successive petition. Instead, they raised them in the context of the prior appeal that Randolph Moore had in a motion for remand, and this court said no. The proper remedy avenue is to raise these in a new habeas petition. You can't attach them onto this current habeas petition that's under review. You have to raise them in a new one. And they didn't heed this court's advice. Instead of coming back in a new habeas petition, they went to federal court and alleged these allegations. So there's two ways in which they attempted to raise them unsuccessfully. I don't think that buys them more time, that you get to raise things in an improper forum, and that somehow constitutes good cause because you keep trying until you find the right method. They should have known under the law what the right method was, and they were told by this court what the right method was, and still they delayed and went to federal court, and so that implicates the Coley decision. You can't raise something there and think you've got it preserved. You have to raise it in state court. And by the time that they did, it was like 2.5 years after they were aware of the Brady allegations.
It's within 1 year of the issuance of remitters, so if the RIPO, our RIPO stood, they'd be in that window.
Well, no, because RIPO only adopted this bright line rule of 1 year from issuance of remitter for claims of ineffective assistance of prior post-conviction counsel.
And you're saying this doesn't slip through that, it can't go through that window?
RIPO did not reach other types of claims. It was limited, I think, to that type of claim.
But you're saying the Brady issue can't go through the ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel window? In other words, ultimately that there was some failure in how that was raised on the first.
The counsel was ineffective in failing to raise it. Oh, I see what you're saying. I didn't read their brief as making that type
Okay,
of
that's what I'm trying to find out.
I didn't read their brief as going that way.
Okay.
I don't think that's the way it was raised below, but I see what you're saying.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you.
So I think I may have, let me look through my notes real quickly. The case is 35 years old. I don't know how many times we have to, they're worried about piecemeal litigation. That's why they want to try to get this Brady claim in and have a similar one-year rule for Brady claims as they do for ineffective claims like in the RIPO case. But Brady, we've already got cases. We've got Hubler. We've got Hathaway. that indicate you have to raise the Brady claims within a reasonable time of discovery, not remitter. We've already got a start date, and you have to, you can't just sleep on your rights in the hopes of bringing them all together in one comprehensive petition. That's a dream that that's ever going to happen. Look how many times, how many layers of review we have. The reality is there is piecemeal litigation, and this isn't the end of it. There'll be another habeas petition. The litigation will go on. It's gone for 35 years. No one exhausts their remedies. There's so many layers of remedies, so much piecemeal litigation. That's just the reality of the system that we have. So it's a bit ironic that they claim they want to raise them all together. If the court wants to stay with the one-year time issue for claim coming back on claims of ineffective assistance of first post-conviction counsel, that's a rule I can live with. That does simplify things. I think that will help ease litigation. That saves us on some of the analysis, but that shouldn't apply to Brady claims. Brady claims are something different. You don't get to just sleep on those and accumulate all your claims and litigate them in federal court and do discovery under the more liberal rules of federal court, and then save it all up and then come back to state court and file some massive petition, because that won't be the end of it. They'll come back time and time again, as we've seen. They're going to have to show something substantial, having shown that both Flanagan and Moore, the two shooters out of all of these defendants, the juries have reserved the death penalty for the two shooters continually. They've got to have something much more substantial than they have here. I guess there's nothing new uncovered that is such a substantive worth that we can say, wow, that really would have made a difference. Something just a little bit new, a little bit more mitigating, that's not enough to reverse for a fourth penalty hearing. And I don't think we need to get into the merits of the Brady claim at all, because it's just not timely raised. I think we need to stick to those procedural bars, because it has been litigated so many times and so repeatedly. And sure, to satisfy curiosity, you can always have an evidentiary hearing, but at the end of the day, 99% of this was raised before, and the evidentiary hearing isn't going to change the fact that it's untimely raised. You're just going to get a little bit more details, a little bit more facts, and that's not helpful to resolving these claims. This is a perfect example of why we need to have some finality in these things. You can't let them just go on for 35 years, because the federal courts haven't even looked at this. Who knows what the federal courts are going to do when they finally get around to addressing some of these claims. We'll find that maybe if they find that the Brady claim has merit, it'll be 40, 45 years, and then they'll reverse and remand. So,
but our job's made it a lot easier, and so is the federal court's job made easier if there's an evidentiary hearing. When there's not an evidentiary hearing, especially on mitigation issues and stuff, and Brady, it's the cold record right now is all we have. Did they offer any office of proof when they asked for the evidentiary hearing?
Well, they've got affidavits. I think that's pretty much is an offer of proof. We know what their witnesses would say, and for purposes of denying it without an evidentiary hearing, we accept those allegations and those affidavits as being true. Angela Saldana has testified repeatedly in this case, and she's never said that she was coerced and threatened and made to answer it a certain way. And so I don't know that we have a strictly cold record. I think there is lots of testimony here, and we can accept their allegations as true. And I know I disagree with the court frequently on the need for evidentiary hearings, but after this many years, we have to start drawing things to a close. We can't just continually reopen and reinvestigate things. I feel strongly about that. I think the law is that there's a preference against evidentiary hearings. We're supposed to resolve them without expanding the record if we can do so. And so we accept their allegations as true, and if we can say it's still procedurally barred, then yeah, there's no need to reopen it and have yet Angela Saldana testify again and deny that she was coached or coerced in her testimony, or that that she lied. In effect, that's where they're going with this, and it's just supposition at this point. They don't have an affidavit from Angela Saldana saying that she lied and gave untruthful testimony here.
Do you agree that Avant was working with Peoples off the book, or in Justice DeGucci's expression. In other words, that the information was not in the possession of the state.
Well, there's certainly nothing I've seen. And this case predates me. I was in high school when this case
right, it's a long case.
Nothing I've seen that would indicate that we have anything like that at all. What they've got is circumstantial evidence from which they want to infer that, but I don't think they have any direct evidence of that. And that's how it often goes. There's whether it's allegations that we've made some sort of deal with some testifying witness or we've withheld something, it's usually just based on some sort of inference. Usually with a Brady claim, you've got to walk in and say, here is the document that you withheld. Instead, what we tend to see is, well, look at this writing on the wall. We think where there's smoke, there must be a fire, or there must be something here that they withheld. And I don't think they've got that here.
See, one of the problems that I see being a criminal defense attorney during this period of time is Murray should rest in peace, but he was horrible. He was a terrible lawyer. I'm just wondering, did they ever raise ineffective assistance of counsel as to Murray Posey?
Sure.
Trying the case by himself?
Sure. David Sheik did.
Did they have an evidentiary hearing on that? Or was it denied?
No. Murray Posey may have passed by that time. I can't recall. But David Sheik performed, where was he? He actually did the second penalty hearing and the appeal from the denial of the second penalty hearing, and then he did the third penalty hearing. And so he filed, in fact, I've disagreed with the court as to how many habeas petitions there have been in this case, because David Sheik raised two before the one that we call the first petition. During the various reversals and remands for new penalty hearings, David Sheik was filing habeas petitions and motions for new trial, and certainly was alleging guilt phase allegations, and specifically against Murray Posen. But no, I do not recall there being an evidentiary hearing, and I don't have the date of Murray Posen's death.
This was a dark time for appointed counsel in death penalty cases. The judges were struggling to find competent people to handle these cases. These difficult murder cases. This was a difficult one where you have two people killing Flanagan's grandparents. I mean, Murray was okay, but wow, not a good criminal defense attorney. So I'm just wondering if there's any life left in that issue when you talked about going back to Jonell or going back to Dave Sheik. Because you're right, those are excellent attorneys.
Well, and one of the things with the passage of time, the problem that we have with is that they did things different back in 1984 and 85. And the things that we do today are going to seem really ineffective and preposterous to the next generation that comes along. The law evolves and changes, especially in the death penalty jurisprudence. When we go back and look at how trial counsel did in 84, we might very well be appalled. But that's why Strickland said you have to avoid the distorting effects of hindsight. They did what they thought was a good job back in the time and with the legal environment that they had. They did the best that they could in that situation, and we do things differently today. We've afforded more.
This was not an easy case in 84 or 85 or even today. It's not an easy case.
Yeah. The brutal killing of two grandparents for insurance proceeds to inherit under the will, and the loss of two lives. And anytime you have two lives, it gives us a good argument that if you give life in prison to someone who kills one person, what do you do with someone who kills two people? So that's why it's been the death penalty every time that it's been reversed and remanded. So
Menendez, thing on Law and Order. They killed mom and dad. They're still alive.
Yeah. So I would ask this court to affirm. Concludes my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Owens.
Mr. Fiedler. Why don't you be specific as to the Brady claim that Justice Pickering was asking about? What's the specifics of the people's involvement in this? You're talking about Wendy Peoples or Robert Peoples?
Robert Peoples. Although I've never heard Ricky Peoples' name, so I don't know about Ricky Peoples.
Actually, it was Wendy Hanley.
Wendy Hanley. I believe she's currently going by Wendy Mazaros, or at least she was going by Wendy Mazaros at the time that we received her declarations.
My question is, what's new and why is it material?
So what's new is the extent to which she wasn't just working with Mr. Peoples and Mr. Evans. The state's answering brief indicates that they sort of suggested testimony. They were working with her on her testimony. What's new is that she was threatened. She was told that if she didn't say exactly what they told her to say, she was going to face prison time or she was going to face execution. And also what's new and different is, rather than sort of this idea that she was working and developing these facts and then reporting them back to Mr. Peoples, she was being given these facts. Mr. Peoples was receiving the police reports from Beecher Avance, and then Mr. Peoples was turning around and feeding that information to Ms. Saldana.
What evidence did you present or was presented on his behalf to support those allegations?
The evidence that was presented were declarations from Wendy Peoples, Hanley/Mazaros, and her daughter Amy Peoples Hanley, who were around at the time and witnessed this behavior from Mr. Peoples, who saw Mr. Evans coming and talking to Mr. Peoples about this case, and who saw Mr. Peoples threatening Ms. Saldana. Amy went with Mr. Peoples when Mr. Peoples brought Ms. Saldana to the trailer, and Mr. Peoples pointed at things and said, "This is what you're going to say about this." There was like a star or something hanging on the wall. He said, "You're going to testify that this was like Satan worship evidence."
Now, was the district attorney investigator present for that interaction?
The declarations indicate that the district attorney investigator was present for that interaction. What the declarations indicate is that Mr. Avance was present at the house talking to Mr. Peoples about Ms. Saldana's testimony, that Mr. Avance was providing police reports to Mr. Peoples, and that they were working together essentially to produce this testimony.
Why was Peoples working for the district attorney? He was a defense investigator when he got out of prison.
It appears that Mr. Peoples had something of a sordid history and had a knack for getting into trouble. And so his relationship with Mr. Avance provided him a way to get out of trouble. And he would essentially provide Mr. Avance with information on other defendants, and Mr. Peoples would then get out of trouble. And in exchange, Mr. Avance sort of helped him out. But this was obviously a mutually beneficial relationship because Mr. Peoples was getting out of trouble. Mr. Avance was getting convictions out of Mr. Peoples' assistance. And then to talk some more about materiality in this case, whether this court wants to accept the corroborated evidence rule or not, the fact is that we have Ms. Saldana's testimony that was presented during the guilt phase and subsequent penalty phases, in which her incentive...
She testified in this case.
She testified during the guilt phase and during the second penalty phase, and then again during the third penalty phase. I believe she also testified during the preliminary hearing.
So four times.
Yes, there may have been an evidentiary hearing separate from the preliminary hearing that she testified at, but I couldn't speak off the top of my head as to that.
Thank you.
But at minimum four times, right?
Yeah, thanks.
So Ms. Saldana's testimony was only subject to limited cross-examination on the basis that she had some incentive to testify against the defendants, but not to the extent that we know now. And the other defendants who testified against Mr. Moore had substantial incentives to testify against Mr. Moore because they themselves were implicated in this crime in one way or another. While we're talking about the Brady plan, I'd like to discuss the differences between this case and Mr. Flanagan's case. The state alluded to sort of law of the case and implied that this court could not rule in favor of Mr. Moore because of this court's prior disposition of Mr. Flanagan's case. And if I could... this court's disposition of Mr. Flanagan's Brady claim was on the basis of the specific timing of Mr. Flanagan's claim. Mr. Flanagan had filed the Brady allegations in roughly 2 years after he discovered the basis of the claim and more than 1 year after procuring the affidavits from the relevant witnesses. The remitter from Mr. Flanagan's first post-conviction proceedings issued on March 18th of 2008, and it appears that he did not file his petition with the Brady claims until September 28th, 2012. So Mr. Flanagan's petition in which he raised these Brady claims was in a substantially different procedural posture than Mr. Moore's petition. Mr. Flanagan had roughly 4 years between the remitter from his first state post-conviction proceedings and when he filed the petition alleging his Brady claim. And so his right to allege anything under Crump or to allege that his prior post-conviction counsel had been ineffective under the reasoning RIPPO would have been untimely. But that's not the case with Mr. Moore. Mr. Moore filed this within 1 year of the RIPPO timeframe contemplated for Crump petitions. And the state is suggesting that Mr. Moore should have nonetheless filed this Brady claim sooner, ignoring the fact that Mr. Moore essentially tried to file this with Nevada, with this court, really could not have filed it in the district court for lack of jurisdiction. And so the state focuses on the time period between when this court issued remitter and Mr. Moore's prior post-conviction and when he filed the Brady claim in this case right now. We're talking about a difference of 11 months. And the state refers to Mr. Moore's federal habeas proceedings as though that took a long amount of time, but Mr. Moore filed those proceedings also within the same 11-month period. And I'd also note that this court did not address the merits of Mr. Flanagan's Brady claim on the basis that this court couldn't because Mr. Flanagan evidently had not provided the complete trial transcripts in his appendix, which of course would make it difficult for this court to weigh prejudice in this case. That's not an issue here. This court can address the Brady claim on the merits. And furthermore, while the case really just has no application here because none of the rulings that apply to Mr. Flanagan can apply to Mr. Moore.
If there had been an evidentiary hearing on this Brady claim, what would have been presented exactly? No, I'm interested in the affidavits. I'm interested in the live testimony by who? Or whomever, I should say.
Well, certainly we would be interested in presenting both Wendy and Amy's testimony about what they witnessed. Ms. Saldana, who I believe is currently going by Ms. Figlin, her testimony would be of interest. I think essentially any of these witnesses who would be able to provide evidence that this evidence was suppressed and that it would have been prejudicial.
And when actually did they learn of this Brady material? What was the date?
So I can't speak off the top of my head as to when Mr. Flanagan learned of these materials, but the earliest that this information became available to Mr. Moore was when Mr. Flanagan filed these declarations in federal court, which was in February of 2011. I don't have the exact date, but I can represent that Mr. Moore's petition, post-conviction appeal was pending before this court, I believe.
Did you represent Mr. Moore in the district court, part of the federal public defender?
Yes, Your Honor.
Was it you or somebody else?
It was me as a member of a team, but I myself appeared with co-counsel in the district court. If I could briefly address the state's arguments as to...
But before you do, I still am struggling to understand how what is new on your so-called Brady claim would have been material, assuming we're able to entertain it. The materiality prong, and it I think it was tied up in Justice Stiglitz's Turner question, but apart from Turner, how would it have affected a jury's verdict on either guilt or penalty?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you don't need to spend a lot of time, but I'd just like to hear that.
If I could just speak briefly to Turner, because I again would like to apologize for not being aware of the case. If the court would like supplemental briefing, we're more than happy to provide it. As to Your Honor's question, the materiality comes in sort of there are two arguments. One is this corroborative evidence rule, which is that Ms. Saldana's testimony was a prerequisite to a conviction against Mr. Moore because all of the other witnesses implicating him were accomplices. Alternatively, this...
But how does this... So you're saying that this would have somehow made a jury completely reject everything Ms. Saldana said? Is that the premise of your argument?
Yes, okay. Because it goes to the weight of her testimony. It shows that her testimony is not reliable because... One,
someone was leaning on her to provide it. That's your argument.
Correct, Your
Honor. Okay.
Unaccomplished testimony.
Correct. The state cites Rusty Havens, Tom Akers, John Lucas, Lisa Licata, and Michelle Gray. We've already discussed the first three. I would just note that Lisa Licata and Michelle Gray both testified that they were aware of Mr. Flanagan's knife and the fact that Mr. Flanagan lost his knife and then bought a new knife to replace it. None of their testimony implicated Mr. Moore. So as to Mr. Moore, we're really only talking about Rusty Havens, John Lucas, and Tom Akers, all of whom were implicated in this crime. And so even sort of setting the corroborative evidence rule aside, there's the difficulty with these witnesses had substantial reasons to misrepresent what actually happened because they could have been liable for the crime. And so the crux of this case really relies on Angela Saldana and her testimony. But if her testimony is not reliable, then there's not a lot for this court to rely on in finding that this error is not material.
Thank you. I understand.
I would just like to briefly discuss the penalty phase counsel's ineffectiveness. Mr. Owens indicates that we provided an expert report, and according to Mr. Owens, it's not really that persuasive. But I would note that it's completely different than what was presented during the penalty phase. David Sheik indicated that this was a less than perfect childhood. This is just a guy who had a slightly abnormal upbringing. But that's not the case. Mr. Moore's childhood was so scarring that he has PTSD now. And both penalty phase counsel and post-conviction counsel failed to investigate these leads. Both counsel knew that there were instances of physical abuse from father figures in Mr. Moore's life, and neither of them conducted any investigation to find evidence to support that, and neither of them hired any experts to show how that kind of abuse as a child has an effect on a person's...
Were they told about it? Were the lawyers told about it, about the abuse and about the less than adequate childhood?
I mean, a lot of times when you represent these type of defendants, they don't want anything to come out in the penalty hearing. They don't want that information to be brought out. You run into a real problem sometimes trying to bring it out in mitigation.
Yes, we know that at minimum Mr. Sheik knew it at the time of the second penalty phase because Mr. Moore's mother alluded to some physical abuse. She then alluded to it again during the third penalty phase. But all she said, for example, in the third penalty phase was, I saw one instance of physical abuse and then I left my husband. But the reality of the physical abuse in Mr. Moore's case is much more substantial. Mr. Moore was getting picked up, thrown into a wall, he was having guns pointed at him, and the jury didn't hear this evidence. And finally, I would just like to note again that Mr. Owens and the state, I'm sorry, Mr. Owens and the district court relied heavily on the idea that any errors in this case are harmless. But this case has been going on for roughly 30 years, and for 30 years, this court, the district court, and the U.S. Supreme Court have all found errors. And at various times, many of these errors have been found harmless, and these harmless errors are accumulating. So to go back to the discussion of Mr. Posen's ineffectiveness, we're talking about a guilt phase where counsel was told that they needed to object off the record. So the jury never received curative instructions, and this court, in addressing that claim, said, well, it was harmless because of the overwhelming evidence of guilt. But we know that the guilt evidence was not overwhelming. And so, again, I would reiterate that we ask this court to reverse the district court, grant Mr. Moore habeas relief, or alternatively, give us an evidentiary hearing so we can show good cause and prejudice.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Fidler. Thank you, Mr. Owens. This matter will stand submitted and will be in recess until 11:30.